Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Markowitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. And boy, oh boy, we had a lot to talk about this week as the volatility continued in the markets and we continued to see some spikes in commodity prices, followed by a quick drop there on Wednesday. We're actually recording this segment about middle of the day on Wednesday, but we're going to talk a bit more big picture about what the potential could be for the world or globally when it comes to commodities and ongoing supply chain issues. We're kicking off the show with Robert Sinn, also known as Goldfinger, over at CEO.ca. Now, Robert, I read over your stuff every day, and I really appreciate some of your company coverage as well as the individual charts that you dive into for commodities. And we're going to start off with oil, because it was Tuesday that I read your morning note where you outlined a scenario where there was or a setup for a blow-off top. Just so happened that that might have been the exact day that we saw at least a short-term blow-off top in oil, because we look at commodities broadly on Wednesday and we're seeing a general pullback here. I'm looking at the crude price and crude is $115 right now. That's down about $8 today and off of its highs of around $130 from earlier this week. And again, kind of that blow-off top phase. Let's first just talk about oil and the general setup that you see in the charts. Where do you think oil could settle at? And do you think those 130 levels are going to be a top for a while?
Hi, Corey and Chad. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. The crude oil market is a really interesting one right now for a number of reasons. Obviously, what's happening with Russia and, Ukraine and the sanctions has really triggered kind of a parabolic move in crude oil in the last couple of weeks. It went from basically 90 to 130 in a straight line. The morning that you referenced at the start, that's basically a call based upon sentiment and really overextended price action. Sometimes I think we need to just tune out the noise. And, we can obviously make the bull case for oil and how it could keep going higher. But at the end of the day, as a trader, I play the probabilities. And when the daily sentiment index is above 90 for multiple days in a row, it actually reached 96 on Monday. That's a very extreme level for sentiment. You rarely see a daily sentiment, the daily sentiment index for a market like crude oil hit 96, maybe once a year most or once every couple of years, and it almost always closely coincides with at least a short-term peak in price. And then you add in the really overextended price action. The charts are all extremely overbought the last several days, and so I made that call on Monday, and it's obviously very tricky to short a market like crude oil. And we've seen these futures markets like nickel or wheat, where they're just going to insane levels. So it can be very dangerous to short. So I used a bear call option spread, which basically allowed me to clearly set my risk level, my maximum possible loss on the trade if I'm wrong. And it also gives me some time, a couple of weeks, for this move to sort of settle out. And as long as crude is back under, let's say, 119, in 2 weeks from now, I'll make a maximum profit on the trade. And even if it went back above 130, I wouldn't lose any more than my maximum loss. So like as you pointed out here this morning, we're trading around 115 to 116. So right now, crude oil is putting a bearish engulfing candlestick on the daily chart. And the last two daily candlesticks have these big upper tails on them, which is often characteristic of a top. We call them topping tails.
Yeah, Robert, it's interesting to see the action in the commodity space in general kind of tie in with the move in oil, because we've seen epic runs in almost every metal and agricultural products. You brought up nickel and wheat there, but we've seen it in copper making an all-time high last week. We saw it in zinc making 20-year highs. We saw it in aluminum. We've seen it just really across the board, whether it's the grains or proteins, all the way up to the energy commodities. So I'm wondering, do you think that this is kind of representative of what's going on in the commodity space here, is a cool down period after such a big run higher?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that it's unrealistic to expect markets to keep moving like they've been moving the last couple of weeks, obviously. A move like 90 to 130 in crude oil is absolutely unprecedented. And there's many other examples, as you mentioned, out there, including wheat and, you know, nickel. It's a very noisy time. And one of the things that I've felt challenged with in the last couple of weeks has been trying to sift through this news, 24/7 news cycle, all the different, you know, ideas and opinions out there about how things are going to happen, play out. And it's really challenging. The one thing that I feel pretty confident in is that the way the world has worked, let's say for the last 20 years, a lot of the assumptions that we've been operating under are now turned on their head. You know, it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle, I guess, right? The Russia invasion of, you know, Ukraine is unprecedented for many reasons. And a lot of analysts, including myself, didn't think that this would happen, at least not on the scale that it's happened. There's a number of reasons for that, but the fact is it did happen. It is happening. The sanctions have happened as well on an unprecedented scale. Russia is also responding, saying that it's going to keep its resources in its borders or sell it to friendly nations like China. So suddenly the world has to figure out where to get basically 1/5 of its natural gas, 10% of its oil, 12% of its wheat, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, down the list. This is a very, you know, resource wealthy country in Russia. And then obviously we can throw in the fact that, you know, Ukraine's economy is leveled right now too. And it just creates this picture where you have scarcity. Suddenly the world is dealing with scarcity. Scarcity and certain, you know, resources that it hasn't dealt with for a very, very long time. And so while, you know, things will continue to be volatile, and this will take time to play out, I'm pretty confident in saying that, you know, the, you know, revenge of the miners, as, you know, Friedland has stated many times, is actually taking, it's taking hold now, because countries are going to have to take their, you know, resources in their own hands. And this is going to create an even greater bull market for miners, you know, around the world, because we need the, you know, metals, whether it's, you know, nickel or cobalt or silver or what have you, you know, or ag like wheat or corn. People want to eat, they want to be fed well. And so this is going to cause the price of all of these things to continue to trend higher.
Robert, do you think this is going to turn out to be a long-term simply Russia issue where we need to focus on the type of commodities that Russia provides to the world? Or do you see other countries getting sucked in here? One main country being China. A lot of commentators are saying, well, this could be the division between East and West. Essentially, do you see other countries joining Russia in potentially cutting off some of the world from their supply?
Yeah, this is not my area of expertise. I don't feel like I would have a really great, you know, answer for that. I think that countries that would choose to be with, you know, Russia in this situation would be making a pretty bad choice for their populations. But countries like, you know, Venezuela, they're kind of stuck anyway, you know. But I think sort of the key revelation from this experience that we're having right now is that a country needs to value more highly its resources, whether it's water, whether it's natural gas, crude oil, cobalt, or, you know, nickel, wheat. All of these things are essential for the, you know, security of a nation and for the strength of its economy, the happiness of its people. So this is going to be suddenly become a major priority in every capital around the world. And then also you're going to have a, you know, military buildup, especially in Europe, Basically, the continent of Europe has sort of operated under this sense of peace and safety for many decades and counted on the, you know, U.S. and NATO to keep them safe. Well, I think countries like Germany and maybe some of the Baltic countries, Poland, obviously, Czech, these countries are going to build up their armed forces and they're going to buy more tanks, more planes, more bullets. And all of that requires more metal, more resources, right?
Yeah, really, the commodities are becoming the currency of this new future that's developing. And a lot of times it's not just for the negative side of the war, but also for all the green energy initiatives and all the different electric vehicle and, you know, the infrastructure needed for that and upping the power grid in so many countries. So there's really a full on push for commodities, and where people source those is going to become just as important as what the scarcity factor is. One other thing that Russia mines a lot of, though, and has been buying a lot of lately, Robert, is gold. And so when they were removed from the SWIFT banking system, their central bank came out and said they'd start buying gold. Gold's had a very big run over the last couple of weeks based on some of this Ukraine situation. It was trending higher before this, but silver has caught up and started playing catch up to gold and had a number of days it was outperforming. What do you think of the precious metals here in light of the recent macro backdrop?
So one of the biggest revelations from this definitely is counterparty risk. And we're seeing that in futures markets in a big way with this big Chinese mining company with the big short in nickel. And I think a lot of people are going to reassess counterparty risk going forward, and especially central banks, which you mentioned the fact that Russia's had its, euro and dollar forex, reserves frozen, essentially. That's, again, another unprecedented action. It's one unprecedented action and event following, another one. And I think that makes gold that much more sought after, that much more valuable, that it's this asset that's nobody else's liability. And it's a key underpinning of any currency. So every central bank is going to be accumulating more gold going forward. And then high net worth investors and institutional investors will continue to accumulate, gold. And you have to think that all of these different factors sort of driving all the same way will just cause the gold uptrend to continue. Now, obviously, in the short term, gold has had a very big run. We've basically gone from under 1800 to almost 2100 in a few months. That's a very, very large move by any stretch. I think we could see some digestion here around 1950 to 2050. But as long as gold is staying above 1900 to 1920, the sort of new area of, support, it's very positive in the big picture.
All right, Robert, we have to wrap it up here. We are out of time for this segment, but good quick little overview here on what we're seeing in oil, some of the bullish outcomes for the precious metals as well, even as we have a bit of a pullback today. But hey, it's still at generally higher levels across the board commodity-wise. Robert, always great chatting with you, buddy. We'll have you back on in the relatively near future. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In the next two segments, we are chatting with Jeff Christian, managing partner at the CPM Group. And Jeff, it was about 3 to 4 weeks that we last chatted, and boy, oh boy, it's a different world currently with the war that's going on between Russia and Ukraine, and quite frankly, what's happened with commodities. We've seen some individual commodities and resources literally go vertical. A little bit of a pullback we've seen this week due to some lessening of tensions between the countries, but this war is still ongoing as we are recording this about halfway through the day on Thursday. It's a different environment for commodities, and I think a lot of investors are trying to make sense of what jumps in prices are here to stay, what impacts to general commodity, maybe supply and demand fundamentals we might see stick around after this war is finished or behind us. Jeff, what's your takeaway from this different world that we have right now for commodities?
Yeah, you know, we've been saying in various reports and interviews over the last week that it's very important for our investors to be able to differentiate between short-term event-driven spikes up and down in prices and longer-term changes in prices that reflect either cyclical or secular changes in an individual market or the overall economy. And you can look at oil, and you can look at wheat, you can look at platinum, palladium, gold, and silver. And in each of those markets, what you saw was that the prices were rising in the fourth quarter and in January and in most of February. And they were rising partly a little bit because of Russia's saber rattling against the Ukraine and the buildup of forces. But they were also rising because of inflationary pressures, strong economic conditions, strong fundamental demand for all of those commodities, and supply constraints. You know, then February 24th came, Russia invades Ukraine, and they all go parabolic. And it's important to understand that, you know, that parabolic move reflects this short-term event-driven thing. And I don't know how long the war is going to last. I know if the U.S. and NATO wanted to, we could probably end it in 48 hours. You know, but it's probably going to stretch on longer than that because we seem to have hired incompetent people again as political leaders. But, you know, at some point the war either ends or there's a clear vision of how it's going to be resolved. And at that point, that event-driven spike dissipates. And we saw a little bit of that this week, but there's more to come later when it's, you know, I don't know that hostilities have actually weakened over the last few days. I think the prices sort of fell because of profit-taking by people who thought that the prices had just risen so high. But when they fall back, they're going to fall back to where they were in mid to late February because you have these other cyclical and secular pressures that have been pushing prices up or pulling prices higher before the war started. And so, you know, I think that that's the way that we're looking at it, and that's the way we're encouraging our investor clients to look at it, too.
Well, Jeff, you raise an interesting point there in that a lot of these commodities were already moving, like you mentioned, in Q4 of last year. They were already moving at the beginning of this year, and then things just really got accelerated when the geopolitical tensions broke out. So a lot of people are assuming that things will just go back, kind of as you just alluded to the pre-Ukraine pricing. But I wonder, when we just saw a CPI reading come out this morning of 7.9%, where there's still been a steady creep higher in inflation, is some of the move still the fiscal and monetary pressures? Or as you mentioned, there's still tightness in supply in many of these markets. Has that all been alleviated? I mean, couldn't some of the price rise be a concert of different factors all acting together?
Well, I guess that's what I was trying to say. But yeah, you know, that's what I'm saying is there have been a lot of things that have been going on. So, for example, if you look at U.S. consumer demand for goods and services, you know, our imports of product last year, the United States imports, trade imports, were up 19% from 2019 levels. So it wasn't just that demand rose as we came out of the lockdown of 2020 in 2021. But demand rose that, you know, back to pre-pandemic levels, and then another 20%, another one-fifth increase in the volume of goods and services. So there are real economic pressures on inflation. Monetary pressures pulling prices higher actually are not nearly as important as a lot of would-be self-appointed pundits on the internet say. you know, the monetary largesse definitely is in there, but the fiscal largesse, which is the Congress and the administration, and not just this Congress and administration, but Congresses and administrations for the last 40 years in worse, ever worsening conditions. The fiscal largesse has been much more inflationary because that actually stimulates real economic demand. So we've seen that going on. You have real demand rising sharply for a lot number of goods and services. You have supply constraints on a number of goods and services. Again, you know, if you look at the February data, food prices were up 7.9% from a year ago. They were up 1% from January. Petroleum-based energy prices were up 25% from a year ago, and they were up 3.5%. You know, gasoline was up 6.7% from January. If you look at non-petroleum-based energy, it actually was down 0.4% from January, and it was about 12% higher than it had been in February of 2021. In February 2021, it's important to remember, that was the first month when you saw, you know, if you go back to February 2021, the headline inflation in the United States was something on the order of 1.7%, as opposed to 7.9%. Yeah, so this inflationary period that we've been in is basically less than 12 months old, or it's about 12 months old now, because prices really started rising in March of last year. So we're 12 months into this inflationary period, and people act like this has been going on forever. And you say, you know, and oh yeah, prices rose the highest since 1982. But if you look at 1982, prices had come down. Price growth had come down to 7% in 1982, having spent most of the previous decade between 7 and 14%. So we had a decade of high and hyperinflation back then, and we're coming out of it in 1982. Now we're 12 months into a period of high inflation, and you can disaggregate it and you can say, okay, what about non-food, non-energy, you know, the core stuff? Well, again, automotive vehicles demand, you know, that's up 12% from a year ago, prices for new automobiles, but it's up 0.3% from January. Used cars up 41% from a year ago, but it's down 0.2% from January. So you're seeing some of those inflationary pressures that pushed prices up so high over the last 12 months starting to dissipate. You've got the energy factor there. You've got the food factor there. You've got transportation costs are much higher. You have supply constraints still. So we're not out of the woodwork, but a little bit of perspective would probably help a lot of investors understand that. I mean, I've had people come to me and they're vomiting because of the stock market's falling. And then I show them a chart of the stock market over the last 5 years, over the last 10 years, over the last 20 years. And I say, yes, your retirement account has fallen all the way back to where it was last March, the stock component. So a little bit of perspective. You're not, I've had investors say to me, oh my God, how am I going to retire? And the same way you could a year ago, because that's where your stock market, your equity investments are. You know, this is not the Great Depression. And you hear people say, oh, highest inflation since 1982. Yeah, but look at where we were in 1982 and the decade before that. Deepest recession since the Great Depression. Actually not. The depression in 1947 was bigger than this, the one that we had in 2020. And 2020, it was like, what, negative 4%? In the Great Depression, it was something like, you know, negative 11%. I actually have it right here because I'm working on some stuff. Yeah, it was negative 14% in the Great Depression. It was about negative 4% in 2020. So you got to put some perspective on where we are. Yeah, we have problems that are not nearly as bad as the conflict entrepreneurs on the internet would have you believe. And you have to understand where we are in all of that process. Now, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is going to change everything because, you know, Russia has really shot itself in the foot.
Jeff, let's elaborate a little bit on that then. Because, look, the environment has come very quickly here. As much as the markets dropped early on in 2020, it was, what, a four-month plummet and then a climb back higher, a pretty steady climb back higher for almost everything. But now we do have this Russia invasion of Ukraine, and we've seen energy prices spike. We've seen PGM prices spike. We've seen energy prices spike. What is going to stick around at the end of this war?
Well, take a look at palladium. I mean, it started January at $1,800 an ounce. Palladium, yeah. And then it got up by February, it was around $2,100 a month. It was trading between 21 and 24. Monday, it shot up to 3,400. Now it's down, it's about 2,900 as we're speaking. My expectation is that it comes back down to somewhere between, you know, 1,900 and $2,200. So we're still going to be higher, I think, when all of this ends. And the other thing about palladium, you notice that we haven't placed any sanctions on platinum and palladium. That's because the auto industry in the world needs those metals. You know, and it's the same as energy exports to Europe. The United States can say, okay, we're not going to take our 700,000 barrels a day of Russian crude because, quite frankly, we could, you know, go to the capped wells in North America, in the United States, and more than replace that in a week. We are not because, again, we have such a great government, but that's beside the point. We can do that. Europe can't do that. So Europe's not going to put sanctions on oil and gas, you know, until they're bombing Poland. You know, it's a very sad reality about the state of politics in Europe and the United States.
Well, Jeff, it's an interesting point because there are certain commodities that are so strategic that they're not willing to go there, like the PGMs. And it just highlights, I know that with the CPM group, you've actually had a couple events on the platinum group metals and just the need for other sources of supply and what your longer term outlook was even out to 2050. But when we see this big run in these metals, like, let's say, palladium, does that bring in the substitution risks that people may switch to platinum and or same thing with nickel? Same thing with copper. I mean, let's not forget copper made an all-time high over $5 finally, which a lot of people thought would happen, but this war just pushed it there. Is there a risk it could get substituted with aluminum? Do you see these high prices as causing manufacturers to look at the raw commodity space differently?
Well, you know, people will substitute where they can. And the substitution of platinum for palladium and auto catalysts and certain other chemical process catalysts has been underway for a couple years already. And this probably accelerates it a little bit. But a lot of stuff like nickel, for example, nickel is used in most stainless steels and you need it. And demand for stainless steels has been very strong on a global basis over the last year or so. So it's a real problem. And the substitutability, it's not necessarily there in that a lot of the things you can say, well, you can use nickel pig iron and substitute away from the nickel ores that we use and get from Russia. But a lot of the things that you could say, well, we can use tungsten or some other metal to substitute away from nickel, they're in short supply. There's probably not enough metal to really substitute away on a wholesale basis from nickel to them. And their prices are probably higher than nickel right now too. Maybe not right now because nickel shot up this week, but you know, there aren't a lot of substitutes for that. There are substitutes for oil, but people are very reluctant and it takes a long time to get into it, you know. And you hear the European government say, well, we need to shift away from our reliance on Russian oil and gas over the next 8 years. And that's not going to help you for 8 years, right? It's a real problem in terms of a mismatch in time.
All right. So, Jeff, let's talk about some other drivers then for these markets moving forward. You already covered the inflation and growth numbers, but how about the Fed? Because we are right around the corner from a Fed rate hike. As extreme as some of the predictions got that the Fed would be hiking by 50 basis points, now expectations have come back down to 25 basis points. And that's where I think the Fed is going to stick. And I believe they're going to try to drive home the fact that they are going to be somewhat consistent in these rate hikes, albeit, man, there's a lot of noise out there in the world right now. How do you think that impacts the markets?
The core economy, I think, pays attention to what the Fed says and what mainstream economists say. And there were, like, there was one FOMC member who said, well, maybe we should raise interest rates 50 basis points in March. And all the others were saying, no, that's not going to happen. And most mainstream economists are saying, no, that's probably not going to happen. And now with the war on, you're definitely not going to see that happen unless something dramatic happens in the next 6 days before their meeting. You know, so you hear a lot of noise. And again, you know, I guess investors have to do things. I ended last year, my last video last year, I said, investors have to know themselves. They have to understand who they are. And they have to take command of the noise and the sound to noise ratio that they're allowing into their lives. And you've got to just sort of say to yourself, okay, I'm going to focus on people who have been right. You know, I'm tempted to start a challenge in the precious metals market. Like, you know, the dignity of people who put forth outrageous things and the foolishness of people to listen to them, it's really causes mental illness for a lot of people. You know, and there should be some challenge or some pledge that, hey, if you're saying that silver's going to $100 or gold's going to $10,000 or the dollar's going to collapse or our interest rates are going to 8% this year, and they don't, you have an ethical obligation to stop saying this stuff in public. You know, I mean, because you've got a lot of people who get really upset and they're really concerned about it. And they probably, you know, should be listening to actual economists and financial analysts and people who understand this stuff and not people who are just trying to sell them precious metals at inflated prices.
I think that's a solid point, Jeff. There should be more accountability. And I would even say that extends to the mainstream economic financial people, though, because there's a lot of them that said inflation would just be transitory for a couple months and that, you know, we wouldn't see it. That there's people that are surprised that the Fed waited this long to start hiking rates. They thought they'd be hiking them a year or two ago. A lot of people called the pandemic crash wrong. They called the Ukraine situation wrong. So there's a lot of bad calls, I guess, across the board. But one thing we've heard a little bit more of, and not to get out onto a limb here, but we have heard calls of the potential of a recession for three factors: the doubling or even tripling of fuel prices, the fact that the yield curve is getting pretty flat. It's only 20 basis points now between the 2 and the 10-year mm-hmm. note. And if those invert, that's usually a signal. And then there's also those calls for slowing growth in GDP. You know, GDP for the first quarter is anticipated to be pretty close to zero. So do you give that any weight that people and investors maybe should be more defensive than they have been over the last few years, just because there is that risk of this Fed rate hiking cycle tipping things over into a slightly recessionary situation?
Yeah, you know, we have a recession built into our economic projection, at least for the industrialized world. But we don't have it starting until 2024. Yeah, obviously, GDP is going to be pretty low in the United States and a couple other countries in the first quarter of this year, but I think it pulls itself out. And yeah, the reality is that it's virtually impossible to project the future, to predict the future. We project. We don't predict, we project. So we look at where we are now, we look at where we've been, we look at recent trends and levels, and we say, okay, what's a reasonable probability for the future? And you run all kinds of scenarios. You know, when Greenspan was at the Fed, I think he had 30 different economic scenarios, and he didn't try to pick the right one. He tried to pick policies that were less destructive across the most reasonable scenarios to expect. You know, and I think that people need to really do that because, I make projections. Everybody makes projections. You have to have a vision of the future if you're going to be an investor or an investment advisor. But you have to, the investors themselves have to say, okay, who am I listening to? What's their track record? Does this sound reasonable? Or if I stopped and I turned off my computer and I went onto the porch and I watched the sunset and I thought about this, I would say, what that guy is saying just doesn't make sense. And then you invest in your convictions, or you say, that guy might be making sense, but I need to go back online and find some other people who either might contradict him or might substantiate further what he's saying. You know, people just don't do that. And we see that in the precious metals. I mean, I've had a lot of clients who are billionaires who have made a fortune in other industries. And then they decide to put fund that fortune in gold. And when they do, everything that they knew about how to study an investment and make a decision based on data and detailed analysis and reasonable expectations goes out the window. And they call us up and they say, I was watching this old codger who's 80 years old online, and he's saying that gold's going to $10,000 next year because Biden's a communist. So I want you to help me buy gold. I've seen that over and over again. When it comes to gold and silver, people throw every bit of reason out the window, and they act on impulse and beliefs and the last thing that they heard. And you can't do that. Well, you can, but you'll lose money doing it.
All right, Jeff, I want to also talk to you about the majors, the large miners, especially in the precious metals. Those have done pretty well, and we actually have seen general increase in investment demand for the majors. They've actually moved up in this environment of a higher gold price, and undoubtedly, they have to be making money at these much higher precious metals prices. You also did a video on majors and how they hedge some of their sales. Give us a rundown on the environment you see for the major companies, the major miners right now, especially in the precious metals.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have suffered, but they are doing better in terms of their equity prices right now. And part of that is just because everybody's running into gold and gold assets. And there are any number of investors who do not invest in gold. They invest in gold mining shares. You know, in fact, probably the majority of our investor clients are gold equity investors as opposed to gold investors, but they queue off of the gold price. So the gold majors have done well because the gold price has risen so sharply in the last several 2 weeks and in the last, you know, 2 months too. They still have issues, but, you know, as I said in that video, there are two sets of performance metrics to look at. One is operational metrics, and that's where, you know, said, yeah, they've got to be making money. In fact, they've got to be making a lot of money. If you look at a typical mining company and they have maybe a cash cost of, you know, on average of $800 and an all-in sustaining cost of maybe $1,000 or $1,100, and the price is $1,900 or $2,000, they should be making about 100% profit margin. So operationally, they should be doing well. On the other side, which is their equity side, that's where they've suffered. And they've suffered because there were a lot of investors who were turned off by years of underperformance. And they have been addressing those issues. They have started giving out dividends. They have been reinvesting a little bit more wisely than they used to. And I think that that's starting to show. There's a lot more to go in order for the larger gold producers to rebuild the trust that institutional and high net worth individual investors want. But I think that they are moving in that direction.
All right, Jeff, we're going to wrap it up there. Look, there's a lot of cross currents driving the commodity sector broadly, but commodities have skyrocketed. Some absolutely gone vertical, and we're all trying to figure out where a reasonable level is going to be for a lot of these commodities as we move through, hopefully, the end of this war between Russia and Ukraine, as well as this Fed rate hiking cycle that is going to start up in less than a week's time. Jeff, thank you, as always, for your time, buddy. We'll chat again in probably about a month's time. I hope you have a great rest of your week.
You too. Thanks.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are chatting with Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, and also writes the Mark to Market blog. I will post a link within the weekend show posting. And Mark, we've talked a lot about commodities in this weekend show. We will also touch on some of the commodity moves, but you are really our in-house currency expert here. So I want to focus on some of these, again, pretty extreme moves in currencies, starting with simply the U.S. dollar. Now, the U.S. dollar, we all know how much it's weighted against the euro, and Europe is broadly continuing to struggle with the ongoing war between Russia and China and some of their energy costs, as well as other implications when, well, they're putting sanctions. Everyone's putting sanctions against Russia. Fact of the matter is, though, the U.S. dollar, after starting last year, so 2021, pretty much at a bottom at 89, steadily climbed through most of 2021, dropped a little bit at the tail end of the year, and then has really popped this year and has reached levels right around 99 on the dollar index. Mark, how do you balance out how much of this strength in the dollar is really just a war premium and how much is actual strength in the dollar because traders like what's going on in the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that both are right in the sense that there are good things happening in the U.S. relatively, and you also have this war, and that the war is really undermining European currencies, and not only the euro, but until this week, Poland, Czech, Hungary, anything proximate to the war. So I think that the dollar strength is broader, and here's one way to think about it. As you noted, the dollar index is heavily weighted towards the euro, European currencies. Two of the U.S.'s four largest trading partners aren't even in it, Mexico and China. But as a rough and ready proxy for the dollar, it captures like the general trend. But one thing that doesn't really reveal as much, I'd say, is what's happened to dollar yen. Typically, given the risk-off mood, weakness in stocks, the war, you'd expect the yen to be better bid. But today, ahead of the weekend, the dollar has risen to new five-year highs against the yen, above 117. And this, I think, is partly a reflection that the U.S. yield, 10-year yield, is flirting with 2% level. But you've got a broad-based dollar strength. And the other point I'd make is that, and this is why I think it's not just the war, but look at what's happening. So I track the two-year interest rate differentials, which I think is, I don't want to get into the bill market, and sometimes it just gives us a broader perspective. And I find it does line up nicely often with the currencies. So say last year, last October, both Australia and Canada offered about a 20 basis point premium to the U.S. And now both are near a 20 basis point discount to the U.S. That is to say, U.S. has higher interest rates than Australia or Canada. And even against Germany, it used to be the Deutsche Mark. Now with the euro, I find it still very sensitive to this two-year interest rate differential, which is basically back to late 2019 levels, above 200 basis points. What this means is that, just to like boil it down in a nutshell, what it means, people are getting paid to be long U.S. dollars.
That's an interesting trade too, right? Being long U.S. dollars into a Fed rate hike. Now, that might have implications as well on dollar strength, as well as the interest rates that you're talking about, where the 10-year has rebounded back up to around 2%. How much of this is predicated on the Fed, and how much is also predicated on the Fed being able to get at least a number of consistent rate hikes out the door in the relatively near term?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. You know, so the Federal Reserve does meet next week, and I think everybody and their mother now is looking for 25 basis points. I was never really convinced that the Fed's leadership wanted a 50 basis point hike to begin the cycle. But in any event, it seems quite clear they're not in favor of it anymore. But I think that, I do think the Fed rate hikes, but here's what I'd be careful about. And again, we have this historical patterns to go on. You can't deduce these things from first principles. But in the past, what's often happened is that the dollar rallies ahead of the first Fed rate hike. Maybe it's been telegraphed. The market anticipates it. And we get something that looks like buy the rumor, sell the fact. So that after the Fed hikes rates, it's like delivered what the market has expected, people take profits. And we are getting some extreme readings in some of the currencies as far as the momentum indicators as we head into the weekend.
What extreme readings are you talking about? Share with us what's caught your eye then.
You know, when I was earlier in my career, I would try to find the perfect trend line, mathematically ideal, all these things. But now I want to draw the trend line the way the typical spot trader would, because I want people to act on it. And if I just have this imaginary perfect trend line or this perfect thing that nobody else looks at, doesn't develop that networking effect that we need. So I try to use the technical tools that are common, like the MACD, moving average crossover, convergence, divergence, and you have a slow stochastics. And these, you know, think about how big of moves we've had. These are getting extreme readings. And so it wouldn't surprise me to see a bit of a pullback. But also, ahead of the weekend, who knows what's going to happen in Ukraine with Russia. The U.S. and the U.K. are warning that Russia may be engaged in false flag kind of operations, essentially blaming Ukraine for developing biological or chemical weapons. And that would give them, that is Russia, a justification seemingly to use them. And so the U.S. and the U.K. have called Russia out. But ahead of the weekend, it seems to me that many people don't want to take on more risk.
That is true. But we have seen kind of a general shift towards safer assets, right? And also towards commodities. We saw spikes in commodities almost across the board. Some commodities like nickel, boy, oh boy, they have shut down trading, canceled trades in the nickel market. Why aren't we seeing commodity currencies do better then?
Yeah, no, it's kind of interesting, right? Because for the last, most of February into early March, the strongest major currencies were the commodity currencies, Aussie, Kiwi. Canada was strong. And we've seen those currencies weaken, even though we've seen flows into like the stock market. So for example, one of the interesting things about this past week's activity, even though most of the major stock markets have fallen this week, Canada's been up most of the week. And so I think we're seeing this generally is that one is the currency market is driven by short-term flows. And the way commodities are going to help Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Brazil is probably over time. They get a little bit more money for their exports, but in the long run, what's going to really drive this is going to be money being invested in the commodity space, expanding output, foreigners taking a hold of some companies to secure those supply chains. So I think that the relative strength of the Canadian stock market is notable, but in general, I say that the currencies are driven by these short-term flows, while the commodity story is really a medium or longer-term investment theme.
Do you think we are in what a lot of people are saying is another super cycle for commodities then? Has the world changed that much on the back of maybe let's just even say the COVID washout, that very quick drop we saw across the board, demand come back in, and now the Russia-Ukraine war, different supply lines being set up?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. So you think about something like oil. Russia exports, say, 5 to 6 million barrels of oil a day. How is that going to be replaced? Russia and Ukraine make up whatever it is, 30% of the world's wheat supply. How is that going to be made up? They make up about half of the world's sunflower oil. How is that going to be made up? So I think that they're right now, given the state of things, the war, I think that it's creating a shortage of these commodities. They're going to be difficult to meet without Russia. And how will this, when I say it's difficult to meet, how does the market distribute a scarce resource, higher prices? And so I think that's what the bottom line, I think, from the ECB meeting this past week, from what the IMF has said, and I think what the Fed is going to say next week, we should be braced for higher inflation for longer. And that this could mean then, so people like me, I think we're looking for a stabilization, say April, May, in inflation readings. And now looking at what's happening, maybe not until October or Q4.
So inflation is sticking around, hey? And I know a lot of people, a lot of mainstream media was saying that inflation would be coming back down, but this war, quite frankly, puts a whole other catalyst behind higher inflation or that narrative. How does that trickle into the markets then? How does that trickle into Fed policy?
Yeah, so of course, you know, we saw this from the ECB this week as well, where they tempered the amount of bonds they're going to be buying going forward. And I think we'll see the same kind of thing from the U.S., where the Fed wants to react to the higher inflation and recognizes that we've got a very strong labor market. Powell seems to think that he and the Federal Reserve can engineer a soft landing. That is a slow down inflation without driving the economy into recession. I'd say that generally speaking, you look at the 2 to 10 year yield curves, and those have really flattened. And that's warning us, I think, among other signs, that maybe a recession later this year, early next year, which really plays on that stagflation scenario, which I'm still not fully there yet. But that's the one that we have to deal with.
What's it going to take to get you more on that stagflation bandwagon? We are hearing more and more about it. And I realize we need at least another quarter, if not a couple quarters, of more stagflationary type data. But what's it going to take to convince you or turn you into more of a stagflation believer then, Mark?
Well, here's my problem that has to, for me, that has to be like overcome, is that I need to see like what quarters are going to be negative. What's going to drive us into the recession? And so here's the kind of growth that on a quarterly basis, that the, say, for the sake of an argument, say that Bloomberg, median forecast in the Bloomberg survey, just to give you what these numbers look like. So I think everybody recognizes Q1 is going to be weak. The Atlanta Fed's at zero, and the market says it could grow about 1% or so year quarterly, you know, the quarterly GDP number annualized. But then it says a bounce back in Q2, back above 3%, still at 3% in Q3. 3% growth for the U.S., that's not really stagnation, that's above trend. And so we don't get down to trend till the very end of this year. And by that time, I think that we'll have other things to be easing. The supply chains would have eased. I can't imagine this war between Russia and Ukraine lasting that long either. And there's other things that will be working to boost commodity output. Maybe it's Venezuelan oil. Maybe it's the Iranian oil. Maybe it's strategic reserves. You know, we've barely tapped them even. So I'm not there yet, partly because I still think that inflation, this kind of inflation, is not the stuff that keeps it. What we want to watch is like the underlying things. Like I know that central banks watch wages, but the commodities just is really, really taxes use. It really slows things down more than fueling like sustained, say, demand-driven inflation. And I'd like to see what happens with growth. I mean, it's still possible that new stimulus measures, for example, in the EU, they're talking about another possibility of a joint bond issuance to help fund energy and defense. In Japan, which because of COVID and these states of emergency that they've introduced that go until later this month, the Japanese economy could contract here in Q1. And they're talking about a new fiscal stimulus package ahead of the summer elections.
So is that what we need to depend on for the demand side of that whole equation being some more stimulus? Because quite frankly, it does seem like the consumer is getting squeezed. And even if we see a bit of a pullback in energy prices, they are still generally higher. Food prices are generally higher. It does seem like the consumer is slowly reaching their limit.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem, especially in democracies. You know, when we have elections coming up, UK has an election in May, local elections in May. We have one in November. I think there's a lot of political pressure to help avoid squeezing the middle class. But I think that the difference between this and COVID, I think as far as like thinking about spending goes, is that under COVID, it was a generally shared problem. And it was, you know, it was a huge payout to replace lost income plus. However, this, I'd say, is more of a military Keynesianism, where the new spending will be justified for national security grounds. So that suggests a bit of a narrower base for it.
So, Mark, let's also talk about the gold then, because, look, gold was screaming higher. And as much as that could be on the back of higher inflation, we've had higher inflation for a little while now, and negative real interest rates. Gold really did get breaking out of some key levels on the back of this war. And look, the volatility continues. Just this week, in about one day of trading, or about 24 hours of trading, gold had over $100 swing. At one point this week, it was up by 2080 level. And at another point, it was down 1960-ish. Some big swings here, but overall gold is still hanging out, let's say, closer to 2000 than it really ever has for a prolonged period of time. What's your takeaway from the moves in gold, and how sustainable do you think prices are, let's say, above 1900?
Yeah, I tell you the truth, I'm a bit worried about gold from a technical perspective. I'm also thinking that here's where we are at the war, to the extent that the war is driving gold higher. Here's where I think we are. Russians are about to surround the capital. And if there's not going to be a slaughter, it's going to be because the Ukraine government capitulates. And they can capitulate by doing a couple of things, like that Russia's demands. Change the constitution to prevent NATO. After all, it's quite clear now to the Ukrainians that NATO is not welcoming them. And to recognize sort of the facts on the ground. And the facts on the ground, like we say in Chicago, possession is 9/10 of the law. Russia possesses Crimea. The separatists possessed their regions, or part of their regions. And I think that to avoid a slaughter, that this war cannot go on much longer without really intensifying this human tragedy that's unfolding. Already something like 2.5 million people have fled. So that for me, the risk that there is a ceasefire, a truce, or some kind of end of this war soon makes gold a bit vulnerable. But technically, I think it's even more disturbing. So I'm looking again at these the same technical indicators. Look at these slow stochastics. The slow stochastics are rolling over, and they did not confirm this week's high. Like you say, it was near 2070. The slow stochastics didn't make a new high, and they're rolling over. So to me, like a bit of a potential bearish divergence, right? Because we go with the indicator over the prices. The MACD are flatlining at overbought levels. So I kind of think that we might have seen the high. We might have to go back up and test. Maybe it's on a bad headline or something, like the 2030, maybe even 2050. But I think that the next big move is going to be lower. And this is partly what we saw with crypto too. Part of it might be not just the Russians buying gold or other people around there buying gold to preserve their money, but it could be people anticipating Russians to buy it. And that's what we saw in crypto. Remember, early on, we saw a big run-up in crypto, and people said, well, this is the Russians buying. And then it turned out that later, as people did the reports and really studied those flows, it wasn't so much Russian buying, but other people buying, perhaps in anticipation. So I think that might be the story with gold. And remember what's happening, too, that the U.S. 10-year yield near 2%. Higher interest rate increases the opportunity cost of owning gold.
Now, what about the argument that even with higher rates, we still have negative real rates? Inflation is still running high, and your outlook even said that inflation will continue to be high for a while.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I just, my sense is that most of us don't really think about real interest rates, right? We collect a coupon, it's nominal interest rate. I think about the yield of stocks. When people look at the yield of stocks, they talk about the nominal yield, the return on their capital, not really in real terms. But I hear you. I mean, that's why I think maybe gold is holding up so well. My guess, though, would be that we see below 1900 before we get to 2100.
Do you see the outlook for 2100 this year then? Is there enough catalyst on the other side, even if gold does have to pull back a little bit in the near term?
Well, you know, this week, part of the news this week has been that the U.S. and the U.K. are warning that Russia may use chemical and biological weapons. If they do, I think it would represent a new escalation. So that'd be one thing that could get gold really to rally. And the other thing is if the war widens. Imagine that Poland's idea of transferring planes to a U.S. base in Germany and then transferring those planes to Ukraine makes Russia begin bombing a NATO member. This war could still get out of control in the sense that it could still be a NATO versus Russia confrontation. I think that would be very bullish for gold. I don't think that's the base view or like the central scenario, but it's surely possible still.
Yeah, nobody wants more war, I don't think. But hey, we'll see how everything moves next week, especially on the back of the Fed rate hikes and the press conference where we always see some volatility, especially when Powell is getting grilled on future projections where rates are going and what the Fed's going to be looking at. Mark, thank you, as always, for your time, buddy. Great having you on the weekend show. We'll chat again in another couple weeks. And everybody, thank you for tuning in on this weekend show. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend. You can always contact Chad and myself through email. That is fleck@kereport.com and chad@kereport.com. Everybody, Mark, you too. I hope you all have a great weekend.
Thank you. Good luck, everybody.